Got
And
it.
here we go. Good afternoon, everybody. This is a podcast on Rotary Radio UK, and our guest is Andy McConnell, who is, I think, best known for his appearances on the Antiques Roadshow. Andy, good afternoon.
Good afternoon. Yeah, I'm better known for that than my role in the Brinks map robbery, but yeah, it's
Yeah.
the roadshow rather than the Brinks map.
Yeah, okay. Do you still have some of the gold buried in the garden or
No, I've actually my armchairs are actually made of gold bars.
Oh,
I've
fantastic. Yeah.
got a few left over.
Yeah. Well, perhaps if we can get some photographs, we'll put them on the website.
Yeah, right. Yeah,
Yeah.
this is between you and I. I don't want everybody to know.
You don't want it broadcast to the world. I can understand that. I looked out on the internet, as one might do when doing this sort of research, and I see you described as an author, journalist, glass expert, and all sorts of other things as well. How would you describe yourself?
Nitwit, nitwit,
Yeah.
definitely. Loudmouth, show off, conceited, idiot, antisocial, aspo, earning, vicious, rabid, and hungry. Those are most of the things that I am.
Yes, I can't understand in that case why you're not president of the United States.
No, where I would, of course, be president.
Yes.
I mean, obviously, Boris was even further out than me, which is how he managed to end up in that insane situation where he was whatever he was here. Anyway, yeah.
Okay, I suppose one of the barriers which would stand between you and being president of the United States was your nationality, and I see that you're trying to trace your Scottish roots.
Oh, well, yeah, there was that story. I mean, that was, I mean, look, you know, that was somebody called, a Scottish newspaper called me. I mean, I'm quite happy to make stuff up. I mean, you know, I don't think that factual accuracy is the top of my list. I think attempting to be funny is much higher on the list. It's quite interesting, actually, in that I did a story. An interview for the Sunday Telegraph about, I think it was called Fame and Fortune. That's what it was, written by John Wright, which was a Q&A sort of thing. And frankly, it was just dismal. I mean, he did absolutely no work on it at all. He just transcribed the interview and published it in the paper. So about 2 months later, I had a call from a journalist working for the Sunday Mail, Mail on Sunday. And she said, I'd really like to do a story about fame and fortune on you, just identical story. And I said, well, I'm not going to do it. She said, why not? And I said, well, number one, I can't stand the Daily Mail. Number two, I did an interview with the Sunday Telegraph a while ago, and it was so boring that actually I sent myself to sleep reading this twaddle. And she said, well, what's going to make you agree to do the interview? And I said, well, you know, some degree of say so over the story itself. And she said, oh, well, by all means, I can read it through with you because obviously accuracy is paramount. And I told her, I said, I absolutely don't care two hoots about accuracy. It's just got to be funny. Which and fun, and she agreed to do it. Donna Ferguson, she was great. I mean, it was a much better story. The Telegraph one was absolute rubbish. And the one in the Mail on Sunday was much better. And I accused my mum of what is it, the world champion cocktail drinker, and I mean stuff like this, you know, just complete rubbish. But it was vaguely amusing, you know, which was much more up my street than factual
Yeah.
accuracy. That said, you know, factual accuracy in my kind of the famous job is pretty important. Yeah, that's kind of important. You can't make it up as you go along on the roadshow, although I always claim that I do. But funnily enough, the reason for doing this interview with you is, of course, I'm doing this fundraiser for Beckenham Rotary, and the that the evening is called an evening of banter with Bonkers and Beyond the Roadshow. And that story is absolutely packed full of make it up as you go along stuff. I mean, just, you know, like the only food we got at school was maggots and stuff like that. I mean, you know, just packed full of rubbish like this, you know, just to make people smile, you know.
It's good to have fun, and it's good to sell tickets as well. I think possibly I ought to say that I think the Rotary Club is the Bromley Game Changers.
Well,
that's all right. I mean, we're following the theme of a certain amount of accuracy and a certain amount of making it up.
You do the accuracy and I'll do the making it up. There's a deal.
Yeah, that seems a pretty good deal to me. When I heard you speak at a Rotary conference last year, I think, or the year before, you were talking about your early career in rock and roll journalism. Perhaps you could tell me how you got into that, and you might have one or two anecdotes.
Sure. I mean, I reckon that was the best gig I ever did. It was funny. It was at the Eastbourne Conference Centre as a kind of fundraiser for Rotary. And I turned up and Nolene was in charge of me. And, you know, she was my kind of minder, and she got me into the hall. And the speaker before me was talking, and I'm thinking, blooming hell, bud, this guy's really great. You know, he's going to... And the more I heard him talk, he was so urbane and casual and funny and cool and all the rest of it. And I'm thinking, I mean, I felt like he was digging a hole for me to fall into, because how can I possibly follow this guy? You know, it was a bit like following Black Sabbath or, you know, it's unfollowable, you know, because it's just the best. And it turned out he was Sir Martin Lewis, who's raised incredible sums of money for Demelza, isn't it? The charity Demelza.
Yeah.
Was, of course, the ITN newsreader. And then I got up and I followed him on stage. And I must say, I was very relieved at actually surviving, getting out of that one alive. And it was funny. It's such a gas. When they work well, you know, like that one, it's almost like levitating, you know, the pleasure, the euphoria that one gets from it working is pretty much unbeatable in life, actually. That said, you did ask me a question which I completely ignored. So I'll now address that question. How did I get into rock and roll? When I left school, I became a journalist. I joined the Suffolk Free Press in Sudbury, Suffolk, and I did an apprenticeship, and I did 2 years. I'd done 2 years on the paper. I loved it again. I've never had a bad job. I'm sure you have a bad afternoon or a bad day, or maybe at a push, a bad week, but I've never had to do anything that I haven't wanted to do. I've really got away with stuff in my life. I've been very, very lucky. And after 2 years, the editor called me and he said, "Look, you know, if you don't take your holiday entitlement, you're going to lose it." And he said, "You've basically written the paper for a couple of years, so you're owed 6 weeks. So I'll give you another couple of weeks. So take 2 months, and you've got all your holiday pay, and I'll put another 25 quid in, and basically go away." That's what he said, in the nicest possible way, or possibly not. So I thought, well, where do I want to go? Where am I going to spend 2 months? And it was obvious that where I was going to go. So I called up my brand new friend, Freddie Laker, and said, "Take me, I'm yours." And he picked me up and brought me in Los Angeles, which was just then emerging as the kind of world center of popular music. You know, London and New York were fading as centres, in large part because of the weather. The weather in New York and London were pretty rubbish, but it was really great in LA, you know, sort of permanent summer. So I had absolutely no idea of anybody there. I just turned up I did actually know somebody. That's right. I knew this woman, Jenny Housel, who was a publicist at EMI, and I've been getting free records of her for my record review column for the Free Press. And she, and just chatting to her, she said, "I'm moving to LA." Blah blah blah. And so, and I said, "Well, I'm going. Freddie Laker's taking me." And she said, "Great, you know, give us a call when you get there." So Jenny was, thank you, Jenny, was a lifesaver. So I called her having arrived and recovered from the jet lag. And she said, "What are you doing this evening?" I said, "I don't know." And she said, "Well, do you want to come to a party with Frank Zappa and whatever?" "Okay, sure, I'll come to a party with Frank Zappa. What are you doing at the weekend?" I said, "I don't know." "You said, do you want to go?" She said, "Do you want to go on the road with Jethro Tull in Denver?" I mean, really? So I've been writing, you know, on Tuesday, I've been writing about pheasants getting run over on the A604. And on by the weekend, I was on the road with Jethro Tull and hanging out with Frank Zappa. And what do you, which do you prefer? You know, so I wrote these stories up, interviews up, and then submitted them to Sounds magazine. They published them verbatim when I got back. And I said, "Do you want to take some more of my old rubbish?" And they said, "Yeah, sure." So I thought, well, blow this. You know, what am I doing going back to the Free Press for? Because I knew I was going to fail my shorthand, which meant that I could never become a kind of authentic, qualified journalist as such. So I went in and saw Jeff Brown, the editor, and said, "Jeff, it's been a blast, but I'm off, man. I'm going." And so I flew back to LA and I spent the next 3 years, you know, with having, I call it my sex, drugs, and rock and roll period, which is factually accurate on three counts, you know,
Right.
really. That was just bloody brilliant. I was 22 years old, 22 to 26 years old. And I mean, it was amazing. I mean, just amazing. It wasn't risk management wasn't the highest on the agenda, I can tell you that. Being a complete maniac was, on the other hand. It
Okay,
was
Andy,
amazing.
let me take you down a side route because you've mentioned him twice, Freddie Laker. How on earth did you get to know Freddie Laker?
He had an airline at the time.
Yeah,
He was
SkyTrain.
all over the papers. I didn't know him personally. No, you
Oh.
don't have to take literally what I'm saying. I mean,
Sorry.
I just bought a 125 quid return ticket to LA on Laker. And it was amazing. I mean, you know, people who, businessmen who have changed the world, you know, Steve Jobs was certainly one of them, but Freddie Laker was another. He was amazing, avuncular. I mean, yeah, brilliant. You know, he made fly. I mean, it was like 500 quid on British Airways or whatever it was, BOAC at the time, or 125 on Freddie Laker. Well, he just opened, it was like the key to the world, you know, bam, there's the world. Thanks, Freddie. So I took advantage of his revolutionary ideas. Yeah, and without him, of course, we wouldn't have EasyJet and Ryanair, mind you. His work worked on time. Last, I mean, I was EasyJet, I was in Londonderry. I went to Londonderry to do an antiques roadshow 2 weeks ago. It was an hour and a half late taking off and 2 hours late returning. So all told, I was delayed for three times longer than my flights, which, you know, is absolutely charming. I didn't mind at all waiting. I did. I'm lying. I did mind being waiting, having to wait. Yeah, anyway. And that cost 225 quid return to Londonderry as opposed to 125 quid to LA. Mind you, there's a slight difference in the timing.
Well, yes, indeed. I when one watches the Antiques Roadshow, you get the impression that the experts are a bunch of jolly nice people who have had very conventional careers up to the time that they appear. I mean, I may be totally wrong, but that's the impression that comes across. You come across as slightly different. Would you agree with that?
I think I probably am slightly different. How I've kept that job for 19 years, Andy McCarthy, well, 20 years actually, if you count in 20th Century Roadshow, which was it's 2004. So I've just completed 20 years working for a roadshow of at 20th Century Roadshow just lasted one season, and then I got taken on with my mate Will Farmer. We were the two who were taken on. Will typically is an auctioneer, and that is kind of what most of them are either dealers or auctioneers. I must say, Ronnie Archer Morgan is different. He was the one, the little black boy in the National Children's Home who had that extraordinary story to tell about the Sooty and Sweet puppets. I mean, Ronnie is more on the kind of left field with me. He was a DJ and a hairdresser and various jobs, kind of more obtuse sort of way of coming in. But it's true, most of them, most of them are a lot straighter than me, that's for sure. I mean straight in a sort of orthodox way. I think I would have to concede that I'm not exactly orthodox.
I think that's fair. Why glass? How did you get into glass?
Oh, well, money. I came back in 1976. I came back from LA, having gone out in 73. And whilst I was in California pretty much most of the time until right at the end, I did about three or four months in New York at the end, but most of it was Los Angeles, based in and traveling out from. I got on best with the American bands. Obviously the English and British bands obviously worked me out as a complete threat, because they knew the references. So they gave me short shrift. But the American bands suffered the delusion that my posh accent was a sign of intelligence. You know, it was obviously completely fallacious, but, I managed to con them into thinking I was all right. So my kind of the bands that I really got on well with were the Allman Brothers Band, the Grateful Dead, Jefferson Airplane, Leonard Skinner, those sort of bands, Santana, going into Journey, which is where Journey came from, out of Santana, and so on. So I came back in 76, and in 77, 78, was it? I got a call from Bill Thompson, who's the manager of the Jefferson Airplane, as it had just turned into the Starship. And he said, we're about to do our first European tour in 20 years. Do you want to come on the road with us? Right. Yeah, well, I might find time to, tour Europe with one of the world's biggest bands. And they were huge. I mean, they're... Spitfire album had been number one for weeks in the States. They really were big. I had been dealing, running concurrently with all this scampery that I'd got up to, maniac behavior. I had been raised by parents who were part-time antique dealers. My dad was actually a tobacco blender, but he had this side line, which was selling, buying antiques and selling them to Americans. And so my childhood was spent, exeats, I was banged up, 9 to 19, I was banged up in, the last school in Britain to maintain crucifixions for routine infractions, beatings, floggings, we really were, flogged to blood. I mean, awful, awful stuff. You tell them that these days that they don't believe you. But it was true. It was Tom Brown's school days. I was one of the last of the very, very repressive public schools. So they would take me out on exeats, and they'd spend the entire weekend or the day, which whatever it was, going buying. So little Andrew could either stay in the car and have a packet of crisps and a bottle of Tizer, or come in the shop and still have a packet of crisps and a bottle of Tizer. So it was a no-brainer, really. My A-level subjects, English, history and art, and it's really weird because I'm now 70 years old and still doing my A-level subjects. It's rather unusual, but I am, it's true. So antiques really were the epitome of English history and art. You know, it was all there, English history and art, antiques. Yes, tick, tick, tick. Especially when they started going, oh, yeah, well, it's George II or, you know, that blah, blah. And I knew these references. I understood what they were discussing. And I could contextualize it and stuff. And so I really liked, so I started buying antiques on Portobello Road from about, I suppose I was about 13 or 14. We lived in Epping on the central line, so I could, you know, bunk onto Epping Station. You know, it's a time where it's really easy to not buy tickets. So I bunk onto Epping Station and bunk off at Notting Hill Gate, which is a straight run down the central line. And we'll go down to Portobello Road, where I was kind of spending my pocket money on antiques. So, and of course, the dealers, every decent dealer is always going to encourage a kid. You know, I've definitely done that myself when, where possible. And I was definitely kind of patronized by some of the dealers who got to know me and so on and liked me, you know, and gave me, you know, half a crown off and stuff, you know. So I would kind of go down to Portobello Road, spend a tenner or something, you know, go completely wild, and then flog this stuff to my parents for 15 quid, who then sold it for 150. In fact, at my school, I was the only one aged 15 who was paying his own school fees out of the profits of my antique thing. And, so there's this train. So in all the things I've done, there's been this antique bit, as well as the other things, you know, living in France and blah, blah, all this, you know, rocking in the free world. And so I worked. So when Bill Thompson, manager of the airplane, Starship, asked if I wanted to go on the road, I had already worked out that Germans had really caught the antique bug. So I took along with me a kind of a swag bag of attempted antiques, as I called them. And we ended up in Hamburg. I mean, that was the first place we were kind of sedentary because it was just bop, 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 gig, gig, gig. So, and I knew people in Hamburg because it was the publishing center of Germany. And it was the Sounds, German Sounds magazine had been my German magazine that I wrote for. And they were based in Hamburg. So I had a word with them, my editor, Jürgen. And he said, you need to go to Eppendorfer Landstrasse because that is where all the antique shops are. And he had a speech impediment, sadly. So I went down to Eppendorfer Landstrasse, and the second shop I went into belonged to this Gunter Kram. So Gunter looked at my kind of measly offerings that I showed him, and he said, Herr McConnell, you have good taste. I like your stuff. You show me. But you must understand that this is antique, and at the moment, the general antique shops with furnitures and paintings, and but in 2 years, this will be just glass. There will be only glass for sale in the shop. It's possible for that you could buy Karaffen and wine glasses in England and Frankreich and bring them to me in Hamburg and sell them to me for my shop. I said, well, it's great. I mean, really fantastic idea, Herr Kram. There's just one problem. Was ist das? I don't know anything about glass. Oh, neither do I. But together, we will learn. And that's what we did. 25 years with Gunter. Really fantastic. I mean, it was brilliant. It really was great. Gunter was a real softy. I made a fortune. Made a fortune at a time when, you know, you know, it's like when you're broke, you know, you can't get a bean. Where, you know, later when you're doddery and old, you know, you've got money gushing out your ear holes. It's really funny that, you know, and we, you know, us post-war baby boomers, I mean, we've just had it so lucky because we all bought our houses for sixpence halfpenny and they're all worth £1 million, you know. What is that geriatric? Do they call it on Radio 4 this morning a geriocracy, which is
right.
Rule by the old to benefit the old. I do get that. You know, it's definitely the way it's worked out. My first house cost me 2,750 quid, and my second house cost 15,000 quid.
Yeah.
Or my daughter's just bought some ghastly house in ghastly Haringey, and it cost us 780,000 quid.
Yeah.
You know.
It's quite extraordinary, isn't it? And, I noticed on one of your websites that the strap line for selling glass and high class junk. And I wondered if you had a definition of high class junk.
Well, I mean, you know, when you set up a shop, you know, we bought that amazing premises, and you know, to turn it into a glass shop. It's all my missus's idea, actually. She's really running it, and I, needless to say, kind of muscled into it and took it over, which is sort of true. She really pleased her a lot, that did. Yeah, right. You say, what kind of shop do you want? And what, self-mockery? I mean, I think, you know, self-mockery is one of the greatest attributes that anybody can have. I mean, to take yourself seriously, I mean, really, you know, I think it's there are too many people who do that. So I'm totally into, you know, you can tell from the stories I'm telling you, I don't come out all that well in all of them. You know, I've had a fantastic life, but you know, really, anyway, so what sort of shop do you want? Yeah, well. Any, we'll offer a cup of tea or coffee to everybody who comes in, as long as we're not too busy. We'll play great music, you know. So we were playing Aretha Franklin and stuff like that, you know, great music, Fleetwood Mac, and you know, our kind of generation's music. And you can bring anything back. You can bring anything back at any point, pretty much within reason, as long as it's in the same condition it was when you took it out. And you give your money back, or you can swap it, or just really easy, loose stuff, you know. And what are you going to call it? Antiques and high class junk. Self-depreciating. It's funny. It is funny to anybody with my kind of sense of humor, anyway. And I think it worked. It really did. People would walk along the street, and you could hear them. I don't know if it was a reading contest, but people go, antiques and high class junk. You know, like. They had to say it. It's a bit like people who are meeting me who have to point. There's this amazing thing about people who meet you who have this compulsion to actually stick a finger up your nose. It's really weird, and it's not young people who do it. It's old fogies. And another weird one is people write to me all the time, probably daily, asking me about their old rubbish that they've got, you know, Auntie Joe left me this, and they never say please. I mean, weird. There are some very strange human traits. I write back to them and say, I'm sorry, but I don't answer, I don't respond, you know, kindly to people who send me emails asking me for free information, who can't be bothered to say please. And I've got the same problem with my 5 and 3-year-old grandchildren, and I'm going to put you in the same bracket, you know.
That's wonderful. And I've made a note, Andy, that if I have the privilege of meeting you, I'll keep both hands in my pockets until
Please do.
we're
Yeah, but
ready
as
for the
we,
conversation.
it only happens the first time. That's, you know, you find this nose up, this finger up your nose, and you've got to pull it out. You know, quite posh people do it. It's really
Yeah.
weird.
Another thing that you're described as is an author, and I note that you've written 3 books. Is there another one in the pipeline?
No, I'll give them that up for, you know, give them that up for Christmas. I'll give them that
Ah.
up forever, actually. Now, there's no money in books. It's just hard.
Right.
And people don't buy books anymore because they put it on Google, and, you know, that tells them, apparently. Yeah, right. Yeah, no, and if, you know, and no, and as nobody writes books anymore, very, very few people write books anymore, you know, the knowledge that I possess, and people of my, I mean, that's the sad thing, is that, you know, I've been very lucky in that when I came into antiques on a kind of more serious level in about 2000, the people with the great, I found that the people with the greatest knowledge were those with the greatest willingness to impart it. So they were very, very nice to me. Or, I mean, you know, I'm fairly woolly and wart-covered, you know, in terms of traditional antique dealing. You know, I'm not your standard, you know, I was on the road with the Jetson Airplane, you know, hang out with the Grateful Dead, which is not really standard for antique dealers. So these eminent people, some very eminent people, really took me seriously right from the off. There were plenty who thought I was a loathsome urchin who didn't deserve to be dropped into a sewage plant. I remember them. I remember them well. I know their names. And I feel that's, it's funny, isn't it? Because we like the people who like us. And they couldn't stand me. Largely because they were kind of jealous, I suspect. Mm-hmm. But the ones who had the greatest knowledge were fabulous to me. And they just stuffed me full of knowledge. I mean, I don't remember my children's birthdays, but I know exactly the wording of of George Ravenscroft's advertisement in the Weekly Advertiser in 1676, saying that he basically had perfected the formula for lead crystal. I mean, I can remember that. You know, I could just turn that on. I can tell you the most arcane glass knowledge. And yet, you know, I do know my children's names. That is.
That helps.
That helps. But birthdays, forget it.
Any thoughts on retirement? We're both no, in well, the.
I got divorced last year, and I have decided that I am going to take my winters off. I'm retirement. Shut up. You know, you'll have to take me out the back and shoot me, or the BBC not use me anymore. And, you know, charities not wanting me to talk for them and retire from NADFAS, you know, it's called the Art Society now, but it's a series of clubs throughout the country, internationally, in fact, that hire speakers to talk about their subject. So I'm still relatively popular NADFAS speaker, though obviously extremely idiosyncratic. I mean, most of them are like kind of roadshow specialists, and many of them read their talks and stuff. But so I'm spending this house is very cold, very difficult to heat in the winter. I live by the beach just outside Rye. And it was built in 1968. It was about 1 minute before story of my life, just about a minute before they brought in building regulations, you know.
Yeah.
So, I mean, basically, it's like living in a colander. And so it's absolutely freezing in the winter. Mm-hmm. And I just don't like freezing, you know. I don't want to freeze during the winter. So I could see this coming from a couple of years ago. So I'm spending my winters. My most recent winters I spent in India, Thailand, and Cambodia. And I think I haven't made up my mind entirely, but I'm going to spend next winter. Similar sort. I haven't been to the Philippines. I think I'll go to the Philippines, which has more old stuff, actually, than the others. And then I've got a tour of Australia in May. So, a speaking tour of New South Wales. So that is. But retire. Why would I want to retire? It's so much fun. Quote working. I mean, you can call it work. I call it having fun. And I said my work is like being paid to have orgasms.
Oh, right, yeah.
I don't know if you can get away with that on your podcast.
Oh, I shall highlight that in the blurb before it goes out. Well, I mean what I was going to say or do you was that when I retired from a very standard career in human resource management, I suddenly found that I was a radio presenter. So if you ever want a job on Rotary Radio UK, you'll get the same fat salary as me, which is a big fat zero, and we'd be very pleased to have you. Andy, just to wind up then, if people want
you're
to
gonna
get...
wind me up. Did you say you're going to wind me up?
I'm going to wind you up. Yeah,
that's a very dangerous thing to do.
wind up the broadcast. If people would, you know, listening to this, they may go to Bromley Game Changers. But if they wish to book you for a talk, how do they do that?
Look me up and send me an email. I am my deal. This is funnily enough. It's what the Sunday Mail. The Sunday Mail said, "Do you want to plug something?" You know, we're quite happy to plug whatever you want as part of, you know, in lieu of a fee kind of thing for the interview. Mm-hmm. And I said, the best thing to do is, as indeed I said, actually at the Rotary meeting in Eastbourne that you attended, I'm free. I am literally free as a speaker. I did North Oxford Rotary, drove up to North Oxford, if you don't mind, for nothing. Mm-hmm. No expenses. I donated a raffle prize. As long as the benchmark, that I just need money to be raised. And I don't really care who it's for, as long as it's humanitarian or environmental. Those are my only criteria. I don't want anything. If you happen to give me a bottle of red wine afterwards, that's just fine with me. But I don't want any more. Can't see the point of fundraising for charities and then taking money off them. That's because it's the height of stupidity. I am happy to travel. The nearer it is, the less I require them to raise. So if I go to North Oxford, I definitely want 5,000 quid raised. Yeah. And of course, I want none of it myself. So I'm doing one in North Finchley. I got three 5,000 quid talks. And of course, raising money for charity is so important because since COVID, of course, most charities have been impoverished by, I don't know quite why, but they have. Charities have found it much more difficult to raise money apparently since COVID. So before COVID, I was doing 25 grand a year, regular, not me personally. I mean, the deal is, of course, that, you know, the Rotarians do all the work, flog all the tickets, which is the hardest thing. Then I turn up at the last minute, show off for an hour or two, then bugger off, leaving them to, you know, taking all the glory with me and leaving them all the work. So, I mean, it's a really great deal for me, but I sincerely want to do charity talks. I really do. And so this one for the Game Changers I'm honoured to be asked to do them, and you know, I'll do anything I can to help them in terms of their quest to raise money. You know, they give so much time, so dedicated, and it's so unfashionable. Young people don't want to do this kind of work, and charities, as a result, really struggle. So I am delighted to kind of do my bit, as it were. I've been so lucky, and so many others have been ridiculously unlucky, you know. Imagine being born with a physical handicap or a mental handicap. I mean, you know, just the idea of it puts a tear in my eye. So I am absolutely delighted to do what, you know, to pay back, you know, what has I take for granted, really.
Yeah. Andy, that's great. And thank you very much for being so generous with your time. And, this has been an absolutely fascinating interview for me. So again, thank you very much.